The inspections are covering every wider areas and every more sites in Iraq.
If you turn someone over to a place where they're likely to be tortured, where you are have reason to believe they will be tortured, you are violating international law.
We need more proactive support on the part of Iraq to be able to move quickly to implement our mandate.
That we considered their declaration to constitute a further material breach.
I mean, our government not only talks about beginning a war against anybody, anywhere, whenever it wants to, and using nuclear weapons, it talks about assassination, and it commits assassination, summary executions.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, January 9th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix met with the UN Security Council today to brief them on the progress of inspections in Iraq. At a press conference afterwards, Blix and Dr. Mohammed al-Baradi of IAEA announced that no smoking gun had been found, but added there is still much work to be done. Blix stressed that Iraq had failed to adequately respond to the request for full disclosure in Resolution 1441.
Good afternoon. We have Mr. Baradei and I have briefed the council, and for my part, I said that we still get prompt access from the Iraqi side, that the inspections are covering every wider areas and every more sites in Iraq, that in the course of these inspections we have not found any smoking gun. However, we are getting more and more information and better knowledge about the situation, and that the declaration, regrettably, has not helped very much to clarify any question marks of the past. Lastly, I tell you that the Council has given very good support, expressed confidence in our two organizations, and that they look forward to the briefing that we'll give on the 27th of this month.
I think we, as Dr. Blix mentioned, it was a very good meeting with the Council today. We both reported that we are inching forward with implementation of our task. We are getting access to all the sites. However, both of us also indicated that we need more proactive support on the part of Iraq to be able to move quickly to implement our mandate. We also indicated that we need more actionable information on the part of governments, and we committed ourselves to intensify the process so we can achieve the result intended as soon as we can. We will provide an update report on the 27th of this month. However, that report, we should emphasize, is an update report. It is not a final report. It's work in progress, and this is simply would register where we are on the 27th of January, but we obviously continue to, we'll continue our work afterward, and we still have a lot of work to do.
You also said that the Iraqis are being cooperative. You also say that the Security Council is being helpful. Aren't you just sitting on the fence and trying to keep people happy all around?
No, I was saying that the declaration didn't provide us any new evidence, and that it didn't answer the questions that were put already in 1991-99 by the Amorim report, and that the Iraqis could have looked at those questions and answered better. So we are not satisfied.
Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix and Dr. Mohammed al-Baradi of International Atomic Energy Agency at a press conference today at the UN Security Council in New York. The U.S. expressed disappointment in Blix's report. U.S. Ambassador to the UN John Negroponte's tone stood in stark contrast to Blix's report and characterized Iraq's posture as uncooperative. Negroponte said that the onus is on Iraq to prove that they have fully disarmed, not that of the duty of the weapons inspectors. Negroponte asserted further that Iraq's lack of proactive cooperation represented another material breach of the UN Resolution 1441. When questioned as to the extent of the material breach by Iraq, Negroponte said it was premature to consider another Security Council resolution against Iraq.
I just have a couple of brief comments, and I'll take a couple of questions, but I'd like to say that 6 weeks have passed since the resumption of UNMOVIC and IAEA inspections in Iraq, and a month since Iraq submitted its declaration. We will hear a more detailed briefing from Drs. Blix and Al-Baradei on January 27th. But today the Council had an opportunity to assess Iraq's response to Resolution 1441 thus far. On the basis of both our own review of Iraq's declaration and the first few weeks of inspections, there is still no evidence that Iraq has fundamentally changed its approach from one of deceit to a genuine attempt to be forthcoming in meeting the Council's demand that it disarm. The declaration represents a deliberate effort to deceive by material omissions that, in our view, constitute a further material breach. The declaration states that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction or programs to develop them, but it fails to answer numerous outstanding questions about its weapons of mass destruction. How Iraq responds and the evidence it provides are important indicators of their cooperation. It is not, however, UNMOVIC's and IAEA's obligation to provide verifiable evidence of disarmament. That is Iraq's responsibility. We have concluded that the Arabic portions of the declaration, which had previously not been translated, but now have been, and they have been evaluated since the December 19th Council meeting, contain no new information and provide no answers to the questions that have been raised. The declaration consists largely of recycled information from earlier declarations to UNSCOM and the IAEA. We do not believe this pattern is accidental, nor do we believe that it is new. President Saddam Hussein's recent statements signal that he believes UNMOVIC and IAEA inspections are illegitimate and must be subverted by any feasible means. These are not the comments of a regime ready to seize the opportunity to comply with its obligations and disarm peacefully. What we have seen of Iraq's actions over the past 6 weeks does not constitute active cooperation. The United States is providing, as called for in Resolution 1441, the full extent of support to the inspectors, experts, information, analysis, and equipment. We support their work to date and reiterate our call that they use all authorities at their disposal to intensify their on-the-ground audit of the declaration and to begin out-of-country interviews. Resolution 1441 calls for serious consequences for Iraq if it does not comply with the terms of the resolution. If Iraq chooses not to seize this final opportunity to disarm peacefully, Iraq itself will bear the responsibility for its actions. I'll take some questions. Yes.
In terms of the larger issue of declaring peace or war, how important is the 27th of January from the U.S. perspective?
Well, this is entirely up to Iraq. I think that we'll have to see what happens between now and then. As Drs. Blix and Al-Baradei said, they're going out to Iraq on the 19th and the 20th, and then they will make their report back to us on the 27th. But we'll just have to see. But it's up to Iraq. Yeah.
Last time we saw you and Colin Powell in Washington, you talked about material omissions that equated to material breach. Today you're putting the second piece of the puzzle in, talking about there's not active cooperation, which is paragraph 4 in Resolution 1441. How convinced are you now, the United States case, that the conditions have been satisfied to call for a second Security Council meeting on the issue of Iraq violations of 1441 and perhaps to take all means necessary to enforce it?
Well, look, I'm not going to go into, I think you're getting out ahead of the process here. The point I'm making is that we said this at after the last session, that we considered their declaration to constitute a further material breach. We are not the only ones who have commented on Iraq's lack of proactive cooperation today. That I think virtually every member who spoke on this subject talked about the importance of not only having a legalistic approach, if you will, to the inspection process, but proactive cooperation on the part of Iraq is required. In other words, just providing access is not a sufficient condition to constitute active cooperation.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Negroponte.
Another lie and lie the love are hanging on, we push and shove. Possession is the motivation that is hanging up the goddamn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut. Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what. Come on, baby. Slaughterhouses are killing hogs, twisted children are killing frogs, poor dumb rednecks rolling logs, tired old ladies kissing dogs. I hate the human love of that stinking mud. I can't use it, trying to make it real compared to what. Come on, baby, now.
McCann and Eddie Harris, compared to what? MEDAC, the British affiliate of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, issued a report last November estimating possible humanitarian effects of a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The reports concluded that such an attack could lead to a human catastrophe with civilian casualties as high as 250,000 within the first 3 months alone. Civilian casualties were very much on the mind of veteran journalist Helen Thomas when she questioned White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer at a recent press briefing.
Ari, you said the president deplored the taking of innocent lives. So does that apply to all innocent lives in the world?
Well, Helen,
and I have a follow-up.
I refer specifically to a horrible terrorist attack in Tel Aviv that killed scores and wounded hundreds. And the president, as he said in a statement yesterday, deplores in the strongest terms the taking of those lives and the wounding of those people, innocents in Israel.
My follow-up is, why does he want to drop bombs on innocent Iraqis?
Helen, the question is how to protect Americans and our allies and friends from a country.
Have they laid the glove on you or on the United States, the Iraqs, in 11 years?
I guess you've forgotten about the Americans who were killed in the first Gulf War as a result of Saddam Hussein's aggression then.
Is this your revenge? 11 years of revenge?
Now, Helen, I think you know very well that the president's position is that he wants to avert war, and that the president has asked the United Nations to go into Iraq to help with the purpose of averting war.
The president attacked innocent Iraqi lives.
The president wants to make certain that he can defend our country, to defend our interests, defend the region, and make certain that American lives are not lost. There's no question that the president thinks that Iraq is a threat to the United States.
The Iraqi people?
The Iraqi people are represented by their government. If there was regime change, the Iraqi... Actually, the president has made it very clear that he has no dispute with the people of Iraq. That's why the American policy remains a policy of regime change. There is no question that the people of Iraq...
For them to make, isn't it? It's their country.
Helen, if you think that the people of Iraq are in a position to dictate who their dictator is, I don't think that's been what history has shown.
White House spokesman Ari Fleischer and veteran journalist Helen Thomas. The U.S. ambassador to Iraq under the Johnson administration, Ramsey Clark, who's been in a unique position over the years to monitor the government's policies up close, is now a foremost critic of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis the Middle East. during a meeting yesterday with members of the Washington Press Corps outlining plans for an upcoming peace march. Clark offered a critique of U.S. foreign policy in the context of the impending war with Iraq and how America's policies are perceived throughout Europe.
When you tour around Europe, you realize that our conduct has created anger, some hatred. It's isolating the United States. The invasion of Afghanistan, I think, dumbfounded them. It's as if the world was ours. We pay no attention to the Security Council. We pay no attention to NATO, which we think is our second gun. And we do what we want. There's also the media, which I think gives a much more constant and vivid picture of conditions in Iraq. I've been in Europe every year on Iraq as well as in Iraq, and doctors' groups and church groups and peace groups and veterans groups and all the rest are talking and working constantly on what's been happening to Iraq. So all that comes together, and we're diverted from it. We have the American people are almost anesthetized on the subject, and they have to break through. But there is a growing movement, and if you don't sense it, you're just not in touch. And it's not measured by the numbers of speakers or the names of speakers. That has nothing to do with it. It's measured by going out into the churches and into the schools and where the people are and see what they're doing and saying. And it's arisen overwhelmingly spontaneously from people who, as they realize how far we've gone. I mean, our government not only talks about beginning a war against anybody, anywhere, whenever it wants to, and using nuclear weapons, it talks about assassination, and it commits assassination, and summary executions, and kidnappings. And we do it in your backyard or their backyard, you know. Well, that gets inconvenient after a while. It can be worrisome. There was an important question to Christians. Should Christians be wary of association with Muslims? And I can tell you that for at least 12 years, to my personal knowledge, there have been major efforts in the Christian church throughout the United States and among religious groups like Fellowship of Reconciliation and major institutional organizations like the Conference of Catholic Bishops to reach out to Muslims. Not wary at all. They're 1.5 billion. They're human beings. They honor Abraham and Jesus in their chain of authority, if you want to call it that, as Christians do. And I think the Christian church, overwhelmingly, there are exceptions who choose to call Muhammad a terrorist. They could call Jesus a terrorist, too. I mean, he's pretty tough on the moneylenders a time or two and other people. The moneylenders are powerful people, as we all know. It's part of the problem in the world. But I think the Muslim people see a need to reach out to each other, to find areas where we can agree, and to work together, because we have to live together. It's like Camus said about Algiers at the height of the war, we're condemned to live together on this planet. We ought to make it as friendly and peaceful and loving as we can. And you can't do that by being leery of 1.5 billion people who are very devoted to what they believe. You go to American prisons and you see the greatest moral force there without question. I go to them all the time, half for all my adult life. The greatest moral force there by far is Islam, because it is present in the prisons. And they're the ones that are respected. They're the ones that are up at 5 a.m. washing. They're the ones that are praying 5 times a day and not ashamed to submit themselves to what they believe is a greater power. It's our burden not to veer away, but to reach out every time we have a chance, Muslim to Christian, Christian to Muslim, and Jews together.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq under the Johnson administration, Ramsey Clark. More and more, the people who house and feed troops, repair and maintain, and even operate the high-tech weapons are likely to be civilians. In the dark recesses of the world, private contractors go where the Pentagon would prefer not to be seen, carrying out military exercises for the American government. We spoke earlier today with Philip Niekirk, a project manager with the Center for Public Integrity. His group recently released a 11-part series entitled Making a Killing, The Business of War.
One of the things we looked at was this phenomenon of private military companies that became very important throughout the 1990s, who were doing a number of tasks and functions that used to be fulfilled by the national militaries of countries, for instance, the United States and Britain and France to some extent as well. And what we found is that increasingly these private armies were deployed in areas in the Third World where law and order had broken down or where there were war zones, to fulfill almost foreign policy dictates that couldn't be fulfilled anymore by national militaries because it had become politically impossible, for instance, to send little armies of Americans into Liberia or even to fight drugs in Colombia because there would have to be too many political explanations back home. So this phenomenon emerged almost to sort of deal with the political difficulties of getting involved in parts of the world where there was basically a breakdown of law and order.
So you're saying that there are situations throughout the world whereby the politics would not allow the government, the U.S. government, for example, to maintain a level of U.S. troops there, I guess under some sort of particular foreign policy mandate. And so they have brought in these private armies to continue the work?
I think to a certain extent that's right. It's a question of accountability. If the national military goes in, there are questions in Congress, there are questions by the voters, if you like, about, you know, what's going on here.
U.S. Troops being there.
Exactly, and there are body bags that have to be explained. If you, on the other hand, if you contract out to companies that contracts are not publicized, whose activities are far away from any reporters or any kind of television lenses, and who are anyway operating in countries that are sort of black holes in terms of information, then it becomes much easier to do what you need to do in those places.
Mm. And so it sounds like they're actually paid mercenaries in a way.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, up until the middle of the 90s, the term mercenary was very current, and then this term private military company emerged. Essentially, I think it was generated by these companies themselves in order to take away the pejorative sense of the term mercenary. But in fact, that is what they are, in that they are soldiers for hire. They're people that go in and do military-style work and get paid for it.
Well, this raises a lot of issues that are of concern. One being, first of all, are American taxpayers' dollars paying for these paid mercenaries?
Yes, they are, in the sense that the State Department, for instance, is one of the contractors where the U.S. tax dollars are going essentially to support these private companies. But in a lot of cases, it's the foreign governments themselves who are doing the contracting. And in that case, the private company has to get authorized or okayed by the State Department and ultimately by Congress, or Congress can object to some of these contracts going out, particularly if it's seen that the country has a very poor sort of record in human rights or is strategically an enemy of the United States. You don't want U.S. companies going out, for instance, and helping Iraq build up its military. So there are limitations on where they will go and what they will do.
Hmm. But they have to come through the U.S. government and get clearance before they are contracted out by a foreign government.
That's right. I mean, there is a system of regulation in force,
mm-hmm.
Which you know, has developed over the past decade or so.
What about the accountability of these mercenaries? Let's just call them mercenaries. That's what they appear to be to me. I don't care if that's politically correct or not. But who are they accountable to?
Well, if they have contracts with the U.S. government, then they're accountable to the contractor. But in the research that we did, we found many cases where the contractors had actually performed very poorly or got involved in scandals. For instance, there was this big sex slave scandal in Bosnia involving one of these companies, DynCorp, and yet it never seemed to affect their ability to go back and get more contracts again from the U.S. government. But I must say, the U.S. companies have that measure of accountability, that they do feel a certain amount of constraint in terms of how they can behave when they're on the ground. there are many others, and there are a lot of South African mercenaries, for instance, who've just been in the Ivory Coast, who might sell their services to both sides, who operate almost as a law unto themselves, and who are responsible, I think, for spreading a lot of the chaos and a lot of the war in Africa.
How do you protect against spying and sabotaging of efforts if you've got these sort of independent mercenaries out there?
Well, I think the biggest problem that they provide is that they're part of a huge arsenal of weapons and expertise that can be used to fight wars. And when people ask why in the 1990s did, you know, 10 million people die in the wars of Africa and South Asia and Latin America, the wars of the Third World, the only answer can be that because the Cold War had provided not just the weapons but the expertise for countries in the Third World to go out and hire armies to go and fight each other. And I think that this is largely responsible for a lot of that suffering and the devastation. And I must make it absolutely clear, yeah, that most of these companies operate within pretty decent frameworks. In fact, it's very hard to sort of make the case that they have been involved in massive human rights abuses. Certainly the American companies are in general better behaved than some of the others when they go into the Third World, and I think we should stress that point as well.
Were any of the American companies involved in the sex slave scandal that you mentioned?
Well, there were officials of an American company, yes, Duncor, and that was publicized at the time.
Well, that doesn't sound like they were behaving very well.
Yes, no, you're right. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is relative to, for instance, the behavior of some of the people that we've seen recently, very recently, in the past month or so, in the Ivory Coast. Obviously, because they have to get contracts again with the U.S. government, so they're very conscious, I think, to some extent of the need to at least preserve something of a reputation.
And these are American citizens that are hired by these companies?
Well, they're American citizens as well as citizens of other countries. They're citizens of, shall we say, Russia, Ukraine. There are often South Africans used because there are a lot of South African soldiers from the old SADF that are sort of around waiting to be hired at any time.
Why is the U.S. government having to do this? I mean, other than what you mentioned at the beginning, that they're trying to surreptitiously further a political agenda that would not be popular, does the fact that there is no forced draft in this country sort of minimize the number of troops that we have available, and therefore
I don't think it's the number. I think that what happened, you know, you had this incident in Somalia in 1993, you know, that was on the, you know, that you saw in the movie Black Hawk Down, where, you know, the U.S. got involved in a war in the Third World that it didn't understand, and it lost, I think, 18 or 19 U.S. troops, and it was terribly hard to explain back home. And I think after that, the U.S. just sort of felt that, you know, there are certain wars that it couldn't get involved in as in a national sense because they just didn't have the political support. And, you know, even in the Balkans, it took them a long time to reach the conclusion that they could actually, as the U.S. and as part of NATO, actually get involved. As a result of which, for instance, in Rwanda, they stood back, and the West and the United Nations stood back while this terrible genocide happened. And I think that there was an awareness after Rwanda as well that while, you know, you couldn't really get involved as the U.S., there were a lot of situations where you would have to insert your soldiers either in peacekeeping or in other, or to preserve possibly oil deposits that had come under attack, or to fight the drug war, as we found in Colombia. There were times when you would have to outsource, you'd have to contract out to people who, while not being officially part of the U.S. payroll, were certainly U.S. companies and therefore could be relied upon to carry out foreign policy.
Philip Niekerk is a project manager with the Center for Public Integrity. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll talk with a couple of nuns in prison for doing more than just praying for peace.